Is there a writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us.
Words to Write By listeners.
Hello.
So I just wanted to let you know that we have two process groups on meetup.com. You can go to our website and there are two posters. One is a process group where we just chill and hang out with other writers and have a chat and ask questions. And if you have any concerns about the writing process or whatever you're working on, you know, we all kind of just work together and help you out.
Yeah, it's been going really well. Actually, I look forward to those Wednesdays because often I'm like, I have this question. I need to know what everyone else thinks about it. And it's been really helpful.
And you never know who's going to show up. Sometimes, you know, there's someone who's already published, you know, a memoir or a fiction book, or maybe they did 20 years ago, but, you know, they still have great insight and really helpful. We've got some new writers and we've got some seasoned writers and we got some in the middle of the road writers. So it's really, really, really fun. The other one is a writing spree and mini craft discussion. I have a million craft books, and so I just pull one off the shelf and I take a chapter and I turn it into a little lesson for about 10 minutes and then you're off to writing.
Yep, and it's at the same time. They're both at 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, so this way, if you've already been making room to go to the process group, you can, on alternate Wednesdays, just come to the writing spree.
Yeah, the last one I did a lesson from the scene book. It was a really good book, and we talked about the pulse of the scene, and that was really helpful. I really liked that.
Okay, let's get to Chapter 5, Scene Summary and Musing. I wonder if most writing books at a certain point start talking about scenes.
They have to.
Because we've seen this in at least two other books.
Yeah, they were in fiction.
Right.
The process books didn't.
No, not so much.
Talk about them.
Not as much.
But all of the prescriptive ones so far has covered scene.
Mm-hmm.
So overall, so far we have read 5 chapters of this book. We're on the 5th right now. What do you think of the book so far?
I feel like it's picking up steam. I feel like the initial chapters were pretty generic. As we go along, there's more useful information for writing your memoir.
I agree. The first few, yeah, it was scaffolding. It was like, okay, here, these are the things that exist in memoir. There were examples, but she didn't explain them. Like, she told us these things existed, but didn't teach us how to do them.
Right. I didn't see how what she was talking about would necessarily apply to a memoir. If I was a memoirist, I mean, it's good to know there are different forms, but you're going to pick one form and use it. So it doesn't really matter what the other forms are. Whereas every memoir is going to need scene, summary, and musing.
Right. And this chapter is awesome because for me, you know, I like examples. She actually has examples. So I thought the previous chapter was my favorite chapter, but now this one is my favorite chapter.
I still really liked the previous chapter. I thought that was fantastic. But this has got some good stuff in it. So let's start with summary.
All right. So first she starts talking about summary. And she also talks about scene. She uses the metaphor of like a camera.
You know, of a film.
Of a film. There's long shots and short shots. And a summary is a long shot. And she says that one way of understanding scene and summary is to think of them in cinematic terms. The summary is the long shot, that one that pulls back to a great distance, embracing first the whole house, then the street, then the neighborhood, and then becoming an aerial shot. It takes in the whole city and maybe the surrounding mountains too.
And then, you know, she translates that because obviously film is one media, writing is another, it's different, but she equates that long shot of all those visuals to time. We use summary when we want to cover a lot of time in a few paragraphs. And I was thinking of comparing this to Bickham because her comments about Scene really do match some of the things that Bickham said about Scene. But in all of Bickham's Scene and Sequel, and I went back and looked at the index, he does not mention summary or descriptive text in that manner. Like from William Bickham wrote, you know, you had Scene and Sequel and you kept going and you tucked in little visuals when you needed them. And so I noticed also in that he has a book called Setting. So maybe he covers that in that setting book. But it's interesting how different types of writing require different things. And as far as Bickham was concerned, a page turner did not need a summary.
I don't know if I'd agree with you on that one. I think because that book came in a series, I think maybe they were like, oh, don't talk about that stuff because someone else is covering description. Because there is a book in that series called Description.
Right. Right.
So it could have been because of the other books in the series.
Anyway, she covers summary. One thing she says is that summary isn't a particular day. It's not a summary in that, you know, I'm going to say what I did on my first day of school, my middle of school, my end of school. It's when I was in school, this and this and this was happening.
Yeah, she says the verbs return to an ongoing set of actions that took place over time.
Mm-hmm.
Is like time in purgatory where it's just kind of like floating there where these things happened over a period of time, but we're not keeping track of that time in real space.
It's kind of the way your memory holds stuff. Like, you know, when you were doing this exercise activity, like when you're doing running every morning, you know, you remember that one couple of days you really noticed the sunrise, or, you know, some days it was wet or that, but they all fade together. They're all a single memory when you're describing them.
Yeah. She has an example in here. This is a book that she's mentioned before, and she pulled an excerpt from Esmeralda Santiago's When I Was Puerto Rican to show effective summary. And for her, effective summary has engaging details. I'm just going to read the second paragraph. In school, I volunteered to wipe down the blackboard, to sharpen pencils, to help distribute lined paper in which we could write our tortured alphabets with the mysterious tilde over the N to make N, the U, the double consonants L and R with their strong sounds. I loved the neat rows of desks lined up one after the other, the pockmarked top shiny in spots where the surface hadn't blistered. The thrill when I raised my desktop to find a large box underneath in which I kept my primer, sheets of paper, and the pencil stubs I guarded as if they were the finest writing instruments.
Yeah, and that sums up a whole bunch of that things from that year she was in school. The other comment that Barrington makes is that your summaries shouldn't be bad writing. They should be good writing. And this is also a good example of good writing.
Right. Well, there's the things that make them good are the details.
Right, the specificity.
Right. As opposed to Scene, she doesn't linger, you know, she's not lingering on her pencils. She's not like touching them and looking at them and having profound thoughts about them.
Right.
But she does describe them, or she describes to sheets of paper. She mentions that they're pencil stubs, not just pencils.
Right. All those things to make it real. So while summary covers a lot of time, while summary covers a lot of information and it moves you along, it shouldn't just be a way of getting from point A to point B. It should really engage the reader in this world, in your memories.
It does get you from point A to point B, but it has to do so in an engaging way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right? And through that is detail. You know, I feel like there are different purposes, though. She doesn't go into those purposes, but this whole section in this example serves the function to give us a taste of what school was like and how much she loved it.
Mm-hmm.
Which I would assume, I have not read this book, but I assume that she's going to next go into a scene.
Right.
Where maybe she talks about how that was challenged in some way. Where she loved school, she loved all this stuff, and maybe something is lurking that might take that away from her. But that's just my theory.
So Barrington's talking throughout this chapter about how you will need to employ certain fiction writing skills in order to make the most of the story elements. And this is a fiction writing skill that, you know, we're going to set up how everything usually is. And now we're going to contrast it with something different. And that's how you make, when the scene happens, we have a context to say, oh, this is something different than what we were getting. Or you could go through this summary of why you like school and then maybe bring in a favorite teacher that made you like it more. That's a possibility. But or like you say, you can use it for a setup for something more dynamic. Moving on to scene, a scene is very easy to pick out in a memoir because it starts with a specific time and location, like one day in spring, Thursday afternoon, 3 weeks later. So it's got a wonderful signpost of saying, you know, we're coming to a scene, because the first thing you need to do in a scene is you need to ground the reader in a particular day, in a particular moment, in a particular location. So it's a nice, easy way of marking it. You don't do anything fancy. You just have to say, and now I'm going to talk about this day, this time.
Well, I think it depends on the art you're going for, because I have a workshop where my teacher teaches us a technique that she got from a book that has 7 pieces in it to get you into a scene. She calls it an image moment.
Okay.
And it's very specific.
Do you use all 7, or is it like if you use 5 of these, you're doing great?
If you use 5, that's fine, she says, but if you use all 7, you're like amazing. And some of them are interesting, like you describe something that's no bigger than a deck of cards.
Okay.
That's like 1 out of all of them. It's to ground the person in the scene. Why a deck of cards? I don't know. But once she taught it to us, I started looking at books I was reading, like Frank Conroy's Stop Time. And I found a paragraph that actually did all 7 of those things.
It sounds fascinating. You know what? Let's put that on our show notes. Go to our website at wordstorybypodcast.com. So for extra value, for people that really want to go above and beyond, from that day in March in the lagoon to what Renee is talking about, you can check out the website.
Cool.
I've just given you more work to do with the next show notes.
Thanks, Kim.
What else about scene?
So we've covered 2 prescriptive fiction writing books, and this one's starting to lead towards the prescriptive side. So just wanted to remind our listeners that so far all of the prescriptive fiction books we've read have a description of scene, but all of them define it kind of a little differently. So if you go into our show notes, it's under a Bickham episode. I think it's called Making a Scene. I've listed how Gardner defines a scene and how Bickham defines a scene. So you can check that out if you want, you know, to
compare it how Barrington describes scene.
Right.
So what Barrington says about scenes is that like they're a close-up shot, like a camera. They are shorter. They're more specific to particular incidences, they go for a shorter time span. And she also says, you will notice too that this scene, unlike earlier summary, contains dialogue. In fact, the conversation plays a major role in pulling the reader closer to the action and bringing the two characters into focus. So dialogue is very important to scene.
What about a fight scene? There isn't dialogue in a fight scene.
People don't say anything in a fight scene?
Well, they can, but they don't have to, do they? Martin does that.
No dialogue?
No, I'm thinking of a specific one because it was an example on the show notes, but Tyrion and his, you know, hired guy were fighting a knight, and Tyrion was describing what he was seeing. Maybe it's considered a description, but like every movement was described by the people fighting with their swords. And I would consider that a scene.
Mm-hmm. But then you're also writing fiction where you can elevate all of that too. I mean, the chances of you recounting in fiction about, you know, that time that you were stalking out the bully and then attacked them, you could do that. But I mean, if you have a scene, a very dramatic scene that you're describing in the memoir where nobody talked, obviously that. But my guess is that probably somebody talked at some point.
Okay. We don't always agree, dear listener. No, that's not a bad thing.
When you're writing your scenes in your memoirs, and a lot of it's internal, like, you know, you're just observing stuff. Do you interject, like, somebody saying something?
Yeah, I usually put some kind of dialogue just for, like, pacing.
Okay, I think it does help with pacing.
Because people read dialogue faster than they read prose and description, and so I'll throw in a line of dialogue, or I'll put in a short conversation to speed things up.
Barrington says, In the best writing, that kind of information is revealed in the dialogue itself, and the reader gets to know the speakers through their own words.
Yeah.
It's a very powerful tool. And since it is a powerful tool, if you use it in your memoir, it's going to impart more to your scenes.
Right. Some listeners would worry, or at least I've heard other memoirists writing their books worry about the accuracy of the dialogue between characters because we don't have memories that memorize every single thing somebody says in a conversation. And so you have to kind of rewrite it. You have to write it so that it captures the conversation.
That's the thing. I think people get hung up in writing dialogue first because, well, I don't remember how it went. But then you can also get hung up if, like, you actually do remember how it went and it's really long and it doesn't work very well. The other quote she has here, a transcript of real life does not make for an engaging story any more than a photograph taken from your window necessarily makes for a striking picture of your environment. You need to make choices. You need to pick the right phrases to inject. Sometimes you're going to use one or two lines and then you're going to summarize the rest of the conversation.
It's all art.
Yeah.
It goes back to that thing I used to hear in classroom students saying, well, that's how it happened. And you're like, but it has to sound good too.
You want to choose the words that get to the heart of what you want to say. A good technique to determine this is sometimes you can read it aloud and see how it flows. If you're finding that you're writing dialogue and it's boring, probably time to stop and step back. Do you have any other techniques for how you choose dialogue?
I pick what people say that has the most dramatic impact or that helps define their character. Like, these are the types of things that this character says.
Mm-hmm.
And those things reflect how they are as a person. And then I can use that later in the chapter. It has to have a purpose, right? Like, so I put it in there on purpose so that later what they're talking about is important, but not always just what they're talking about. It's how the person says it. And then it informs the piece itself because maybe I want to make a statement about this other character.
Right. So it does double duty. So your dialogue should convey information, like just, you know, move the scene along because stuff has to happen in the scene. But then your next criteria is like, well, is it dramatic? Does it like pop things? Or is it some aspect of this person's personality that really comes out through dialogue? And in that case, you keep it. And if it doesn't, then maybe a rewrite.
Yeah. She has a example here of a scene. Do you want to read that, Kim? So our listeners can get an idea of the difference between scene and summary.
Sure. Sunday morning before breakfast. So we're setting the time. Abdulweya handed me my pique dress, washed and ironed. We're going to mass, she said, pulling out a small white mantilla, which I was to wear during the service. Can I have breakfast first, Abdulweya? I'm hungry. No, we have to fast before church. Don't ask why. It's too complicated to explain. I dressed up and combed my hair, and she helped me pin the mantilla on the top of my head. All the way there and back, she said, you should have nothing but good thoughts because we're going to the house of God. I'd never been to church and had never stopped to classify my thoughts into good ones and bad ones, but when she said that, I knew what she meant and also knew bad thoughts would be the only things in my mind all the way there and back. I think this actually illustrates a lot of the stuff we were talking about. You know, the dialogue definitely has the more dramatic aspects to raise it to a more dramatic thing. It definitely, the abuela saying, don't ask why it's too complicated to explain, says a lot about her personality.
Right. The urgency of it, you know, like, come on, come on. No, you can't even eat breakfast. You got to go.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay. And then it's like, don't think of a pink elephant. Of course you're going to think of a pink elephant. Of course she's going to have bad thoughts there and back. Why do you think she chose to have this in dialogue? Why turn this into a scene and not just say, my abuela came into the kitchen one day and she said we had to go to church. So we went.
Then you would jump to the scene at the church. What you have here is, first of all, the people become real. As soon as they speak, you see them in your head. You see them moving around. They're taking up space and it elevates it to something that you're paying attention to because, you know, someone's saying something, you want to hear what they're saying. You have the phrasing, Sunday morning before breakfast, and something's happening, But then it's the person's voices that bring us into that moment and starts the timer going from that point.
Abuela, her grandmother, she definitely has a presence in this. With the dialogue that the author chose made it so that the grandmother could make commands, even commands of the kinds of things you would think about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just things that she said. She would say things like that. And so it seems like this scene is setting us up for something about what happens during the church.
Right. Well, that would be the next scene. But
yeah, this one's definitely doing double duty here. It's getting us to the church, but it's setting the scene. It's setting the mood and the characters in it.
Mm-hmm.
Just with 5 lines of dialogue.
Yeah.
It's pretty effective. I noticed that just the next page, Barrington, she mentions a piece of advice that's a famous piece of advice that comes from Stephen King from his book On Writing.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks about don't shore up the dialogue with descriptions such as he snapped or she mused or phrases such as he said in an endearing tone or she replied with a sarcastic edge to her voice. In the best writing, that kind of information is revealed in the dialogue itself.
Now, I'm going to say that everybody that reads this can then go to their favorite book and pull out a page and they'll say, look, they did exactly that tag right there. And it happens. It's not like you can't use them. But the thing is, like 80% of it should be he said, she said. It's one of those things you can pull out and use, but an amateur writer, you'll see, uses it on every single tag and it doesn't work. So your default should not be using it. And you pull it in when you really want to make it work. The other thing I'll say is that forcing yourself not to use it makes you work harder on the dialogue. The tag can be a crutch.
True.
And then the dialogue itself isn't strong enough.
It's interesting. I kind of adopt the he said, she said, or they said rule. I will add a description a little bit, maybe in a next sentence, if that was important. I don't know if I use he snapped or she. I should look through I don't actually know if I do that. I thought I wasn't, but now you say it, maybe I have done it.
I think it's more common in fiction writing because we're controlling everything.
Mm-hmm.
In memoir writing, the dialogue that other people are saying, you're observing it. So maybe you don't feel quite so empowered to telegraph what is happening inside them.
Yeah.
Now we get to the third thing. Musing, which is not common in fiction writing.
Right. I mean, there is internal musing in fiction, but the musing that she's talking about here is like on steroids in a memoir.
Mm-hmm.
It's not at the same level in a fiction piece usually.
Right. Fiction needs to move along and you can always come up with some sort of plot or something to carry it through. If you want a character to realize something, it might make more sense to have them realize it in dialogue with somebody else. You know, you want to make things more dramatic. But part of the reason why you read memoir is for judgment and for reflection. And musing allows that.
She says, the musing element of memoir appears in 2 forms. Sometimes it takes the place right there on the page, visibly separated from the experience it is reflecting on. At other times, the author lets us see that she has done her musing out of her sight, but displays the resulting wisdom. What is always recognizable, though, is the presence of the retrospective voice. That's a lot.
Yeah, you want to unpack that?
I don't know. Let's unpack this together, Kim, because I'm still trying to get the difference. So she says some writers might switch back and forth.
Let's back up. So basically, when you're getting into your head in a memoir, you can either go step by step how you came to some realization, how you processed this, how you did this, how maybe you went back and forth and you thought this and then you thought that. That's the writing it out on the page.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can say, back then, I didn't understand such and such and such and such. And that's where, like, you know, I've thought about this. I'm going to give it to you directly.
Okay.
Or after much consideration, I'm going to give you the, just going to give you the wisdom.
Mm.
Package wisdom right here.
Right. You give it away.
Yeah. I did all this work so I can give you the final product, polished version.
That reminds me of, like, composition essays where you just got to give it away. She does have an example here from her own book, Life Saving. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I will read the first short paragraph and then halfway through the second. Okay. She says, I must have been 12 when my father, my mother, and I participated in the Shoreham to Littlehampton yacht race. Actually, I did that race more than once, but I'm talking about the only time my mother came along, the time that turned into a full-blown family story. So real quick, that's the summary. Mm-hmm. Then she starts to muse. The way I see it, the story is about my mother's lifelong terror of the sea and my father's pig-headedness. Or perhaps it is about the absurd pretenses of the British middle class, particularly the male of that species, whose dignity must be preserved at all costs.
So this is one of those ones where she's kind of working it through. And I'm guessing that it's a spectrum. A lot of musings are going to have a certain amount of back and forth of how I got to this. And a lot of musings are going to like have a more tightening and like, you know, here's the valuable wisdom. So it's a bit of back and forth. Mm-hmm. So you don't need to think that you're either working it all out on the page or you're giving a perfect summary.
I think the important thing to take away from musing, because it is so important, it takes up a lot of the memoir. There's a lot of this. She actually mentions this. The crux of musing, like the purpose almost of it, is the essence of memoir. She says the essence of memoir is the track of a person's thoughts struggling to achieve some understanding of a problem. And the musing here, she's trying to figure out what kind of story this is. And mm-hmm. the type of story that it is will determine how she's going to carry it, or how she does carry it in her mind, and how she thinks of her parents, if that makes sense.
Well, it's going to reveal a whole bunch of stuff, both what she felt maybe as a child and also what she felt as an adult later on looking back at it.
Right. So that paragraph where she muses, mm-hmm. that's what she's doing. There's a problem. I don't know what that problem was, but she's trying to come to terms with how her parents acted.
Yeah. Is it hard to include musing in a memoir, do you think, from your own experience or listening to others? Or is it one of the things that kind of comes out naturally?
For me, it was a process that in the beginning, I took the show don't tell way too literally. And I wrote everything in scene. And I didn't have much musing at all because I thought I'm not supposed to have that in there. But as I read and wrote and went to workshops and wrote and scrapped books, I came back and now I do it a lot. And it's partly because of Bickham. Bickham doesn't talk about musing, but the whole discussion on sequels made me identify what a sequel looks like in memoir. Mm-hmm. And that has this muse element.
Right. It's a lot looser and a lot more important. In Bickham's case, a sequel helped support the scene and helped bring the drama and helped move the story along. It was very much a structural element to it. But musing, it's a good portion of what the memoir is about.
Right, and it's in between the scenes, mm-hmm. or the very dynamic summaries. That was something that was missing. And so this is when people say things like, well, you got to figure things out about your life and stuff. And I'm like, well, this is things that happened. And then I'm like, oh, I see. I have to really reflect on it. And it has to have a meaning. It has to have a purpose.
Riffing off of that, the question is, do you come to this understanding when you are writing the stuff out and working on your memoir, or have you already worked this stuff out in your head, and when you come to the memoir, you bring it? It's the equivalent of the pantser versus the outliner of memoir. For most of us, there's a new level of understanding that comes along with writing, but it's also true that we need to have done plenty of thinking about our lives before we start. That put me in mind for people that had really dramatic things that happened in their life. And sometimes they're public enough that people are like, oh, you have to write this as a memoir. And they come at it with the summary and the scenes, and they know how to write this out. And then they need to step back. That's when the editor says, or what your reader said to you, like, you know, okay, but how were you feeling? How would all this stuff happen? And it's a different level. On the flip side, a lot of us have, you know, lives that are interesting enough to ourselves, but we don't think they deserve a memoir. But when you think about it, there are important things. So we spend a lot more time thinking about why it's important in order to force ourselves to write the memoir. So we have some of this work done ahead of time.
It's interesting. I've always used writing as, I guess that would make me a pantser, but I'm an outliner too. I use the writing to figure things out. And then I go back, and once I figured it out, then I make it all nice and pretty and polished. You have to figure it out. And that's, people read memoir because they want to have that strong connection with a protagonist that's gone through something real, and they have to be in their brain. Mm-hmm. We were talking in a couple episodes ago how the plot gets revealed in like subtitles. You know, it's like they just give it away. It's like, oh, I got hit by lightning. It's like you just gave it away, like a thesis statement, you know? And in a memoir, you do that. The spoiler is revealed from the beginning, but then it kind of loops back around throughout the whole book. And it can't do that without musing or wisdom. Mm-hmm. But I think you have to do it in a way that you're not like on a pedestal either.
Yeah, she says that you should watch out not to let the need of musing push you towards an earnest voice that appears to take itself altogether too seriously. It shouldn't be work to read someone's musings. It should be enjoyable.
You shouldn't feel like someone's force feeding you a lesson.
Like, it's talking to a relative or somebody, and they start talking about stuff, and you can't stop them, and they're just working through things. And it's like, you can't go anywhere, and you want to go somewhere. You don't want to be that person in your memoir. You got to make the reader want to hear what's going on in your head and what conclusions you're coming to. And you can do that through humor and snarkiness or various other techniques that we've talked about. Like, you need to make the musing enjoyable to read.
Right. Very enjoyable. What I think was fun in this is she has a musing from Frank Conroy's Stop Time. And I really, really love this memoir. It's a very famous memoir. There's a chapter in it I've diagrammed the hell out of called Yo-Yo Going Down, you know, A Mad Squirrel Coming Up. And that was this whole chapter about puberty and him going through puberty. And it was brilliant. So if you go on eBay, you probably get the book for $2 and just read that chapter. It was great. But she actually puts a paragraph in here of Frank Conroy musing in his book. And something that I found fascinating was how different the voices come out. Like, if you go through a couple of memoir books, like highlight where they muse and then compare them. And then you get a sense of what voice sounds like and what styles looks like. So in this paragraph, this Frank Conroy Stop Time says, today nothing happens in a gas station. I'm eager to leave, to get to where I'm going, and the station, like some huge paper cutout or a Hollywood set, is simply a facade. But at 13, sitting with my back against the wall, it was a marvelous place to be. The delicious smell of gasoline, the cars coming and going, the free air hose, the half-hearted voices buzzing in the background. These things hung musically in the air, filling me with a sense of well-being. In 10 minutes, my psyche would be topped up like the tanks of an automobile. Like, it's delightful.
Yeah.
But then, before this example, she gave another example, and it sounds completely different. This is from Mary Gordon, Seeing Through Places. Still, there must have been some place, some part of a room, a corner of a hallway, where light struck, where a yellowish patch, transected by striped shadows, came to rest on a wooden floor. Some moment of a day, when the windows were let open, the house must have been not dark. But I do not remember such a time or place. Like, it's very floaty and philosophical, right? Whereas Frank Conroy is like, a 13-year-old boy is like, oh, I love working at this gas station. So cute.
Is there anything else you want to say about musing before we go on?
Oh, let's go on.
Okay. So to sum it all up, the last little bit of advice that she gives is that scene, summary, musing, there is going to be one of these or maybe more that you write really well, that you like writing, that you're good at, that the people that critique you say, I really, really like that. And there's going to be one that you don't do so well. And you want to work on that one you don't do so well because they're all critical to a memoir. If you get all three of them, you've got the right tools for a memoir. But if you don't like musing or you don't like summary and so you just keep skipping it, there's going to be something missing in your memoir. You agree?
Oh, yeah. Well, I skipped all the musing when I first started. And then I had to work on it a lot. What about you, Kim? What What are you good at and what do you have to work on?
Well, I definitely needed to work on musing too when we do these exercises. It's not something that I naturally put in. Musing takes up a lot of space. When you're trained as a journalist, when you're trained to write stuff out, and if you need to have some kind of like, this is how I got to this conclusion or something, you do it quick and efficiently and you don't spend time on it. So I didn't realize I was applying musing, but I was learning to add musing to my writing pieces for these exercises.
What about fiction? With your experience, do characters muse?
I mean, they do, but everything's in service of the plot. Like, I do have characters musing, but I have other stuff going on. I'm using sequels more than I'm using musing. The sequel really helps elevate the plot elements. It sets us up for the next case. It shows the significance of what happened to the character that it happened to. But it isn't in of itself what people want to read. If you read fan fiction of favorite stuff, you'll find a lot of musing. People that write fan fiction often enjoy doing the musing, figuring out how the characters thought about that. But from the published writer's perspective, you only have so many words to use.
I mean, characters try to figure out what happened. Like, that's part of a sequel, isn't it?
Right, but it's figuring out what happened in order to advance the plot. Mm. In memoir, sometimes you're figuring out what happened just simply for your own peace of mind.
But you still have to serve a through line, don't you, in a memoir?
Yeah, I mean, you do, but, like, sometimes the musing goes off on a tangent, and then, I don't know, I'd rather I don't write memoir, I don't see how it's used. I just know that when I'm writing fiction, the mm-hmm. sequels are very tied. It's back and forth.
Interesting. So when I read Bickham and we're reading sequels, my brain went to musing. Mm-hmm. It was like, oh, that's what goes in between. And I guess I naturally filled that in and I just assumed that's what part of what he was talking about. But now I'm thinking I misunderstood that this whole time.
Well, no, think about what his sequel is. Sequel starts by having a reaction. Mm-hmm. And that could be like an emotional reaction or a dialogue or whatever. Then it restates what the issue was. And then it analyzes that. And then it moves, the character then comes to a conclusion and then has a new path of action. The sequels are very structured. I don't think that musing follows that kind of through line, does it? When you do musing for stuff, do you set up your musings in such a way that at the end of the musing, you've come to some conclusion that's going to affect your actions in the next scene in your memoir?
Maybe. I don't know. Okay, so I just want to finish off with this one quote because I really liked it. Man, so I've called her this in the show notes. And Bickham was the bullet point king. I'm calling her the quote queen.
Okay.
Okay, so the quote queen has this to say. Remember, it is scene and summary that make for a good story, while musing in some form makes it layered and thought-provoking. Just very good.
Very good.
She just knows how to cut right to exactly what she means. I love her writing style.
Okay, and with that, on to suggestions for writing.
She's got five here. The first one is think of an event in your life when you were less than 12 years old. Write a straightforward narrative of the event in first person without musing or speculating on it.
I like this one. I like this one and number two. So first, we're going to write an event from our life when we were under 12 as a 12-year-old without any speculating on it. And then we'll read through that narrative and jump to number two. Read through the narrative created in number one and think for a while about it. Try to decide what the story is really about underneath the obvious facts. See if you can come up with an opening sentence that summarizes what it's about, such as, when I was 10, I learned something about loyalty, or parental inconsistency can drive you crazy, or my last year in grade school, I discovered death. Now write the story again using adult voice in the first sentence. You may later choose to discard that sentence. Allow yourself to be who you are now looking back at the event. This might be a bit tricky for you because you've probably picked a whole bunch of the really good ones already from your under 12-year-old age. But pick one that you haven't done, that you haven't analyzed, and just try to write it from, and I'll do it too, try to write it from the perspective of when you were at that time without any kind of extra analysis or why you're choosing to write this way or what. Just as a kid, write it. And then step back and do the second part of writing it more thoughtfully.
So we're doing this three times.
Twice.
Three times. She says, write it straightforward, without speculating, and then you're supposed to write it. Now write the story again. Oh, I see. No, it's one prompt.
Yeah, well, you know, it's good that we're getting this cleared out so we don't come back and find we've done it wrong. So, to state explicitly, pick an event when you were 12 or under that you remember and write it as you remember. Then think about it, turn it over your head, and come up with a summarizing sentence to use, and then rewrite that scene as an adult, looking back.
Right. So there's a lot of thinking involved.
Yes. But only two sets of writing.
Two sets of writing. Okay, so two prompts.
Yeah, two prompts.
Okay, cool.
Because I think you'll get a lot more out of it by doing the second prompt on the first.
Right. And I think these two prompts may be the most valuable prompts. That and the speculating one, the one we did previously. These are really, really good prompts if you want to write a memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're doing this all the time.
Right.
She's got good prompts.
Yeah. Okay. We'll get to writing. You guys take care, and we'll be back in a moment.
Bye.
And now we get to exercises.
What did you think of this exercise?
I thought that I didn't give it enough time. I think the idea of letting it sit and think and cogitate in your head, I didn't really do that step. In fact, when I was doing the first one, I was kind of always thinking about doing the second one. So I think that I might have missed a little bit of the musing because of that. How about you?
I didn't do enough musing. I realize now. It's interesting. On the drive over here, I was like, oh, I really didn't take enough of a step back.
Mm-hmm.
I included like interpretation of what was going on in my head at the time. But then I forgot to really take an even further step back. As the adult now making a statement. So, you know, I probably a B. You know, Barrington would give me a B on this. Nice try.
Nice try. Well, let's hear your try.
Okay. The summer I was 12, we stopped going to Great America. That same year, Grandma kicked Grandpa out of the house. We didn't learn until much later that our uncle claimed he was having an affair in his 80s. I was left behind to watch daytime television in the back bedroom alone at Grandma's house while Bob and Justin went skateboarding around town, taking Grandpa's huge camcorder with them. When my brother and cousin did not come home, they wanted nothing to do with me, but I couldn't help but force myself in the bedroom to watch their skate videos with them. Grandma would still take us places like the skate shop, where she bought the boys hats and oversized t-shirts and new skateboards. I was so bored I began excavating Grandma's closets while she was busy watching her soaps or answering calls from her tenants. Buried under an avalanche of secondhand sheets, bedspreads, and coats, I found a cheap, unopened chess set. For the next hour, I set up the board and pieces on the bedspread and read through the rules. With no one to play with, I put it back in the box and stuffed it back under the coats. She would invent tasks for me to do. She'd hand me a Mr. Goodbar chocolate bar, Grandpa's favorite, and tell me to deliver it to Grandpa. He lived less than a mile away now in one of their rentals. By July, I decided to ask if I could go to Great America by myself. When Grandma's car pulled away, I immediately felt as if I'd made a mistake. But I invoked the memories of the rides, the hot asphalt beneath my feet, the cartoonish storefronts. This would be fun, I thought. Other kids were here. Maybe I would find a friend. I walked toward the gate and paid my way in and found myself at the large fountain where a mom rubbed sunscreen on her kid's face. A father adjusted a backpack with a slobbering baby on his back. Kids squealed and charged toward the carousel overlooking a large pool and water rising feet into the air. I walked slowly towards the back of the park. Workers in their colorful hats and vests and name tags counted popcorn tubs or waited bored behind ice cream carts. Rides went around and around with no one on them, the operators letting the machine run while no one yet stood in line. As I passed by the pizza kiosk, my chest felt tight, like a belt was buckled around it, and my fingertips tingled. I found a bench and sat, almost heaving. From the bench, I watched people walk in groups, back and forth, kids jumping, parents scolding, babies eating. As time slowed, I again began to feel visible, almost on display. I invented a story in my head, ready to tell anyone that I was just waiting for my mom who was in the bathroom, but no one asked. Grandma arrived alone to pick me up, and we rode home together. Renee, she said, how would you feel about moving in with Grandpa?
That's a melancholy summer memory.
Yeah, it was a shitty summer.
Great job capturing the sensations and kid Renee version, although I sometimes find that like our kid versions aren't that much different than our adult versions. I mean, yeah. Like, you know, those are the same things you think about yourself if you were kind of in that situation.
Yeah. I guess one could say that that's a foreshadowing, because that was that described a panic attack, which I have now. So I have them. So it's no fun.
Yeah. I found one interesting thing was the whole, like, put yourself into the kid's spot, because there's so many things you don't quite remember. So I almost felt like I was imagining myself as a kid seeing these things.
Mm-hmm. That takes practice. It's hard. One of my, like, years when I first started the memoir, I was like, I don't freaking remember what I was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how I felt. I just know this thing happened.
Yeah. But you captured it really well.
Thanks. Okay.
So that version is kind of just as it happened, as the event happened.
Prompt number one. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then the next one is, first of all, you had to think about it, decide what the story is really about. So what was the story really about?
I decided that the story was really about the summer I learned my grandma had favorite grandchildren and I wasn't one of them.
Okay. Obviously, her not being interested in you comes out pretty clearly.
Well, thank you. I tried. Mm-hmm. I tried. The theme actually did change a lot of things, so that was interesting. It's definitely tied to the musing that I added in, but I don't think I did the musing correctly because I didn't add it in far enough away as an adult perspective. It's still trapped in my kid self version, I think. I don't know. You could tell me.
So basically, you kind of added it in, or did you completely rewrite it?
Oh, no, I just added it in. The prompt says I have to start with the theme. So I started with, the summer I learned my grandma had favorite grandchildren, and I wasn't one of them. The summer I was 12, we stopped going to Great America. The same year, Grandma kicked Grandpa out of the house. We didn't learn until much later that our uncle claimed he was having an affair in his 80s. It was as if a conversation had taken place without me. Grandma never said we weren't going to Great America. Then again, this summer, she never really said we were. During subsequent summers, I just found myself in the back seat of the car, the boys bouncing on the seats as Grandpa pulled into the parking lot. It seemed too odd a question to ask. Why aren't we going to Great America? Like, why lunch existed. By July, I decided to ask if I could go to Great America by myself. Thinking back on this now, I distinctly remember asking not if she would go with me, but if she would drop me off. I seemed to know then that if I was going to go, it would be alone. It was the first time I got the sense Grandma, who hosted every Christmas since I was born, who was the envy of all the kids on the block, was hiding something back, as if she had bought me candy, but when it came time to give it to me, she kept it in her pocket, fingers fiddling the contents and her indecision to deliver. I did not know what to expect going to Great America alone. I wasn't excited in the way I used to be as the entrance became clear while I glided through the enormous parking lot in Grandma Nelson's Grand Marquis. I had visions of the large fountain guarded by flowers at the entrance, remembered the sharp adrenaline rush when the bell rang and the bumper car suddenly lurched forward, the water from the rapids evaporating from the seat of my pants as we hiked to the side of the park where Justin once almost got kicked out for pulling Smurfette's tail. And then I go on a bit about, you know, wandering to the other side of the park, and I say, I was too shy to be the only person in line, so I walked back toward the middle of the park where the lines were fuller, where I could stand inconspicuously, my aloneness not so much on display. Yet the longer I stayed, the more visible I felt. I realized having my family with me, being more than just a lone person, made me belong. I did not feel lost in time, like before, when the sun dropped low before we were ready to leave. No, this was a spell gone wrong. Time was a thick fluid, sticky and slow. By noon, I had the strange feeling of being watched. Even my thoughts felt loud, as if I were speaking them through a loudspeaker. As I passed by the pizza kiosk, my chest felt tight, like a belt was buckled around it, and my fingertips tingled. I found a bench and sat, almost heaving. And for a moment, time sped up, until the belt loosened, and I sat wondering what had happened. From the bench, I watched people walk in groups back and forth, kids jumping, parents scolding, babies eating. As time slowed, I again began to feel visible, almost on display. I invented a story in my head, ready to tell anyone that I was just waiting for my mom, who was in the bathroom. But no one asked. No one asked, I decided, because they knew there was no one here to claim me. I was not theirs, and they were not mine, and I did not belong here. While waiting for Grandma to pick me up in the parking lot by the entrance, I imagined the boys in the car just waiting to laugh at me, as if they knew what had happened, as if the world also thought I was the butt of a joke. She arrived alone, and we rode home together. Renee, she said, how would you feel about moving in with Grandpa?
That was really good.
Was it musing?
Yeah, I think there was musing. Even though you're implying that we kind of musing from Kid Renee's version, it felt like you had a better understanding than 12-year-old Renee would have. Like, the panic attack really came in clear in that version because you get the whole, like, the sensations and it just, it's much more, I think you should, but just much more self-aware.
Right.
Part of the reason I think she chose us to do a 12-year-old is that you're not supposed to, or under 12, is that you're not really as self-aware at that time.
Yeah. It's hard because you have to, like, what was I thinking? And it's funny because I couldn't, it's very hard to put into words. Like, I knew the thoughts in my head, just images and feelings, mm-hmm. but you have to put them into, like, thoughts that people can follow.
Right, right. You have to give it almost extra narrative. I mean, you capture the sensations of a kid wandering through a park. The other thing, too, is I felt like you really could see the camera following you in this second version. You could see a certain amount in the first version. And maybe partly it's because I've heard it the second time through, I'm picking up more details. But, like, I could really imagine that as a movie of Kid Renee wandering through the park.
Hey, verisimilitude.
There we go.
Thanks, Mr. Gardner.
You said you didn't think you did enough musing. Was right. there, like, a look, part of it you weren't doing enough musing, or?
Well, it felt like I wasn't giving my adult perspective enough. Maybe I did, because clearly I had to be an adult to be able to say those feelings out loud. Mm-hmm. But I felt like I should have taken a further step back.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, as the adult, I could have responded to this event. I don't know. Maybe I'm overthinking it.
I think you may be overthinking it. I think you're thinking about making a whole memoir versus an exercise.
That's true. I might be thinking that.
Because I found that when I was writing it, every time I stepped back, like, it was more and more text and I was further and further away from the action.
Yeah. Well, the cool thing about, well, not the cool thing about musing, but the one sensation of musing, if, you know, dear listener, if you're like, oh, I need to add musing to my memoir, you get further and further away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that just kind of happens. Mm-hmm. That's part of it.
But then you gotta get back.
But then you got to get back. That's the key. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't know. You liked what I wrote. So if you wanted to write something that sounded similar to mine, you just slap scene right in there. You just go, you know what? Throw in the detail. That's what I think. I just stop thinking in the musing and then I just go straight back to the image of what was going on in front of me. But maybe that was too jarring for the reader. I don't know.
I think what really worked was you did bring the theme in very small spots along the storyline because, you know, there's a couple mentions of the cousin and your brother, but, like, what really came down to it was really said it was that, you know, you were feeling isolated and alone and all this stuff and not fitting in. And it's never actually clear that you're correct about it until your grandmother says that bit about moving in with your grandfather.
Interesting.
And you finished it on that note. But, like I could see that another person might have taken it in that way and then put the musing about what it meant.
Or afterwards?
Your realization that this meant that your grandmother didn't love you. I mean, I don't think you needed it because it was pretty obvious. It's a pretty bold statement.
Yeah. Well, I waffle between that all the time when I'm writing. I'm never sure, like, how much I need to say out loud and how much is, like, not art anymore. You know? Like, if you're too heavy-handed, it's like, well, what's the point of reading a whole book when someone could just say that?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people are much more heavy-handed. I don't. You've read a lot of memoirs. Do you think that a lot of memoirs are heavy-handed, or do you think they tend to just let the reader decide?
I think that the more commercial the memoir, the more heavy-handed. It sounds bad, but that doesn't mean it's necessarily a bad thing. It just means that it's not marketed for the merit of its prose, but for the
conveying of its message.
The conveying of its message and the crazy story it has to deliver. I'm not saying that's bad. I'm not judging it. But that's like a commercial memoir, just like a commercial novel, you know? Mm-hmm. But then there's more of a literary approach.
Mm-hmm.
And the literary approach maybe, you know, delivers it more through showing than telling. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm still working on my draft, which, by the way, I finished. That's right. I finished it. Thank you, Thank you, clap track. Thank you. Really appreciate it. And I would like to thank my co-host, Kim, for this momentous occasion. Thank you so much for helping me.
That was pretty awesome with seeing you get it all together and just having you know for once you had your memoir.
The glee was real.
Yeah. Yeah. Back to the exercise. Would you recommend this exercise for somebody? And if they were doing it, would there be any additional information you'd add to Barrington's prompts?
I thought this was an amazing activity. I hadn't read one quite like this, but she nails the musing, and I think that's a hard thing for people. It's either really easy for them to do when they do it too much, or it's the opposite, which was my problem. And she has all those examples. Mm-hmm. If I were to supplement anything, I would just find more examples in memoir.
Okay.
You know, some have more musing than others, and I would just like pull a chapter out for students and maybe have them read a chapter from, you know, like a commercial memoir and have them read a chapter from a literary one and then compare mm-hmm. like what their style might more be, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
Would I get what grade do you think she'd give me on this one?
I think she gave you an A. It was really good.
Woohoo! Yeah. Got an A even. Yeah. Sorry.
It's been a good week for you.
It's been a good week for me, yes. I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good.
All right. Well, I think that's it for this episode. If you are enjoying this podcast, we could really use a boost in our ratings and reviews. If you go to Apple Podcasts or some other, or whatever else, other services you listen to, and you say that you like us, we'd really appreciate that.
I mean, like, this is a labor of love.
Yes. Okay. Well, thanks so much, and you guys take care.
Bye.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smith-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
No, wrong one.